RadioInfluence.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to Tennis with an Accent. Australian Open is in full flight, so there's a lot of tennis conversations to be had. This is Saqib Ali hosting the show once again. The show is produced by our partners, RadioInfluence.com. And today we have a guest who really doesn't need much introduction. If you follow tennis over the last few decades, he's a very well-respected voice in tennis. Former Olympic silver medalist and top 10 player from the U.S., Tim Mayotte is here, and he's going to be answering some of the questions that I'm going to throw his way. Welcome, Tim.
Saqib, thanks so much for having me on. Yeah, it's an exciting time in the game.
Absolutely. I get more excited when I get to hear a voice like you who's lived this journey as a player, and you were on the ATP Tour Players Council. You were part of the USTA, so you've worn many hats. So when it comes from you, I think I can, and even I can speak for the audiences. We all can learn and, you know, enhance this conversation further. So before we get into some of the relevant topics that surround the tennis narrative, let's talk about a book that you're writing, and what's the timeline on the book? What is the book about? When does it come out?
The book is called The Framework, and I'm hoping to launch it in the next 3 or 4 months. I'm right now looking at finishing the text and doing some really high-end photography. So, and my point is that as I've reviewed actually, let me take a step back. When I left the tour, I left the game for a little while, and then I got back in via teaching. And I was trying to get a education for myself, and very little of what I read sounded or felt right to me as a former top player. It just seemed very segmented and very flat, both in the video portions and in the what I was reading and also going to conferences. And it became clear to me that there was a lot of great information, but the biggest thing that was hampering stuff was that nobody was integrating movement and technique simultaneously. So most books, most videos, most conferences, when they talk about technique, they talk about stroke production, and then they talk about movement and separate. And that just didn't ring true for me. And so my goal over the last 6 years has been trying to find a language to combine the two. And what I've done is to divide all shots into 7 stages, which is not exactly groundbreaking. But what I've done is every single shot is analyzed from the simultaneous unfolding of feet and technique. And for higher level players, I think that's essential, because really it comes down to having an understanding that technique and great technique improves movement, and great movement improves technique. And to get to the best players, you can't have one or the other. And that has to be true for all strokes now, because all the great players, you know, Match, Federer and Djokovic, what makes me so excited about this era is there's no weaknesses in the best players. And that adds up to these incredible rallies that you're seeing with the players. And if there's one element that breaks down, then the movement hampers the technique. Technique hampers the movement, even in the smallest way. It adds up to a less than perfect player.
So let me ask you this, because I'm sure a lot of the audience from my podcast, and even folks who follow you on Twitter, they also follow the sport but play themselves. So will this book even help club level players like myself, and who want to improve their strokes, and can this change matter for folks like us who are, like, you know, playing with, you know, whatever techniques we have? Is it something easy to introduce, or that's only if you take full-time coaching at an academy like yours, or an official tennis outlet? That's what I'm trying to ask.
The book will be geared towards anybody who's curious about their game, and certainly for coaches. It provides a very pragmatic way to break down all your strokes and analyze them. And yes, it will be specific enough to play a role in developing a, you know, better way of looking at your game.
So let's talk even about your academy. I believe you are part of, you know, you're coaching at that academy at a grassroots level. So tell us more about the academy, how many coaches you have, and what kind of programs you guys have there.
I just started a joint venture with the Thoreau Club in Concord, and we are off to just an incredible start. We have 5 courts, 7 pros. We're working with about 60 kids and expanding, in particular, the homeschool program. My reason I got into coaching were twofold. One was I just hated the way the American players in general were struggling, but also I want to create great players out of New England. When I grew up playing here, there was a number of players in this area who made the top 100 in the world. And certainly that hasn't been the case, except for maybe Jared Donaldson, who obviously the listeners will know is top 50. But he left New England when he was about 10 and moved to Argentina. So my goal is to create really great players. And we're off to a great start. But certainly the homeschool portion is going to be an important part. But I just want to set a new standard for academies in New England, particularly so that kids who really want to reach the heights don't have to go to Florida. So many kids feel that they've got to go down to Florida to become great tennis players. I want to keep them home. I want to give them the chance to reach the absolute pinnacle of the sport.
Yeah, that's wonderful, because I've lived in Massachusetts for, you know, more than half my life, and there's enough of a tennis culture here. But yeah, if we can have homegrown players, you know, who, and I think that kind of success will also start resonating in the popularity of the sport. If you have a local guy competing at Newport, which is, I think, the closest tournament we have, or for the WTA, we have a tournament in New Haven. So I think that's going to just generate more interest. But yeah, no, that sounds.
And also hold on to your breath, because we actually at the Thoreau Club, a big announcement, we're going to have a WTA tournament there this September.
Wow.
So we're going to have $100,000. It'll be the highest level of the Challenger circuit, but it's right after the U.S. Open. We're going to hopefully be able to pick off a couple big names. But that's part of the whole process. You've got to get these kids to see high-level players to ignite their imaginations and then provide great teaching, great coaching, so that they can execute that. So I believe that New England market is absolutely ripe for creating good players. There's a great tennis tradition here, and we plan on getting that done.
Absolutely, and looking forward. And that's a wonderful announcement. And Tennis with an Accent, my team, we'll be there covering the event. So,
oh, great.
So yeah, let's do a segue. When you were here on the podcast last year, we talked about the same stuff, how American men, especially starting from Roddick, you know, there has been a technical, you know, flaw in the backhand, how they move into the stroke. So audiences can go and tune into that archived podcast. But let's talk about Francis Tiafoe, because that was a name that we both discussed. So how impressed are you with his success? Has he made any adjustments to what you talked about when you were on the show last year?
I haven't seen any adjustments. To bring listeners back, I still believe that every shot's got to be perfect if somebody's going to become a top 5 player, for instance. And as we talked about last year, I think TFO's forehand is flawed because of the way he takes his racket back. And it'll be great and very interesting to see how he continues to advance. I think it's going to be a liability for him as he gets into later and later rounds. There's no question that a player of that ability can be get close to the top. Question for my mind, and for certainly American fans who are so desperate for a great top 10, top 5 champion, you know, Grand Slam champion player, is can that player to the very top? Can they win the U.S. Open? Can they win the Australian Open? And I just really like trying to highlight, well, what are the things that players need to work on? And I still think his forehand, while being tremendously powerful and tremendously, let's say, powerful is the right word, and at times accurate. I think it's a liability and will be in the most critical moments. But what I do hope is that he proves me wrong, because he's a great kid. He's a great athlete. It's a great story, and America needs a great champion. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that he can prove me wrong, but I'm not sure if that stroke is going to work at the absolute highest levels. It'll be fun to see him play and see how far he can progress.
By the time this podcast is released, his destiny would be, you know, known as far as his next match goes, you know, where he's going to take on Rafael Nadal. So from a coach's point of view, if you were to break down that matchup, are there any areas where TFO can find a comfort zone where Tomas Berdych couldn't buy a point against Nadal in the first two sets? How does this matchup play out in your mind? And I'm not asking you to make a prediction, but where can TFO find, you know, some sort of a patterns or comfort zone where he can stay with Rafa and, you know, maybe create some scoreboard pressure on the great champion?
It's anytime you beat Nadal, you beat him by taking time away, because as we know, he is the master counterpuncher who then can go on offense. And what TFO is going to have to do is to cut off the angles to the balls exceptionally well. And what we mean by that is when he's just behind the baseline, penetrating into the court with so that he gets the ball early and tries to expose Nadal's court positioning. That's certainly what Federer's done in these last years as he's changed his game style. Djokovic did it as early as way back 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe even longer, 10 years ago, when Djokovic figured out how to play defense in an almost an offensive way. So TFO is going to have to get the ball early and open the court up to get Nadal running. That's going to be the key. Obviously, he's going to have to serve well, and there's no question, because if he's having to deal with second serves, we know Rafa is going to lay back and absolutely rip those balls, get TFO moving, and then it's going to be curtains for TFO. But the good news for TFO is he does move forward at really good angles on both his forehand and his backhand side. So that's one of the things he does exceptionally well. And also TFO has very good hands. So I think, as we've seen Djokovic do and Federer do, using drop shots and drop volleys is going to be very effective. So he has a really good tool set to play Nadal. Biggest question is pressure, and I think how he serves.
So let me ask you maybe a similar question, but in a more broad way here. A lot of players, based on our conversations, and, you know, I live on tennis Twitter, I see what experts say. So it's no secret that a lot of top players, both on both tours, could have flawed techniques, but, you know, that's how they got there. Ernest Gulbis' forehand was an example that has been deconstructed many times in the last 6-7 years. And, you know, he's a confidence kind of a player who's looking to find his game, and looks like he solved that. But going back to TFO, you know, when you and I are talking on this forum, I'm sure he's heard this before. So can a new change be introduced which can instrumentally change a guy's technique at this level, or that's too big a risk for a guy like TFO? How does a player approach that kind of a theory, even when he or she wants to entertain the idea of a change?
Can it be done? Yes, it's been done many times. We've seen Nadal adjust both his forehand and his serve quite significantly. We've seen Federer take different angles to his backhand, although the swing shape wasn't changed, but the angles he's taking to the ball. Now, I wouldn't change TFO's forehand at this point, because perhaps he can prove us all wrong and get to the very top with the current situation, with the current forehand. He's only 21, and he's been steadily moving up, so I wouldn't mess with that. If he hits a roadblock, let's say, in 2 years, then I think he would have to consider, if that was the cornerstone of the problem, then I think he would have to consider rebuilding that. That would be a tall order, but in golf, certainly we've seen Tiger Woods readjust his swing. Gulbis, so the thing with Gulbis, I just don't even think all the other elements were in place. And I guess I have to be really clear for folks. I'm talking about how do you develop the very best players in the world? Yes, players can get very close to the top with a liability. But in today's game, where the courts are uniformly pretty slow and you have to have both offense and defense, these top three or four players have shown that they succeed because they have no weaknesses and they're mentally, tremendously mentally strong. Anybody who has any kind of weakness has fallen by the wayside. It's just the way it's happened. So you can get in the top 10 for sure. You can get close, but why hasn't anybody else challenged the top four for the last, what are we talking now, 12, 15 years? Because to me, movement and technique-wise, they are nearly perfect.
Okay.
And so the question for TFO and for others is, what do they have to do to get to that place? But with Francis, I wouldn't change it right now because he's moving up in the rankings and he's very confident.
So another question about the young brigade of American men. You know, there are a lot of them, and yes, they're the same age group. So is TFO or Donaldson, are these the leaders of the pack in terms who has the highest ceiling, or Mackenzie McDonald, has he impressed you? How does Taylor Fritz measure up? Just a summarized way of looking at, you know, the local talent.
Mackie McDonald really impresses me the way he plays. He's balanced. He's efficient. He is a good understanding of his game. The biggest question for him is, can he hurt people enough with that stature? And I'm not sure he's fast enough to make up the difference in the loss of height. So to me, you have to be super, super great mover, or you got to be powerful, preferably you're both. But so I like his game the most, but I think at his size, whether he's going to be able to punish the best players, I'm not so sure. To me, Taylor Fritz has done a nice job in improving. I think the big important thing for him has been his balance has improved quite a bit. He used to just hit big, but he was off balance quite a bit. So I think he has some upside. Probably not quite as much variety as some other players like TFO. So he's a real, it's been wonderful to watch him sort of steer. He came out of the gates fast, then he stuttered, and now he's moving up pretty quickly. Donaldson is injured, and I'm not sure where that stands at this point. Probably the hardest worker of the group. He doesn't look as fluid to me as some of the other players, and I think that lack of fluidity, for lack of a better term, will hurt him in the long run. He seems like he has to work exceptionally hard to make contact and develop the kind of racket speed he needs to. So I think he could do well. I think he could get to 40, 50 in the world and maybe stay up in that area. And then Riley Opelka, I haven't seen his game enough. It seems like to me Opelka and Michael Mo are a little bit in the same category, although Mo I think is a better mover. So I think we have a lot of really solid players, but nobody with the whole package to break through to the very top. Now again, I think obviously TFO seems best positioned to that, and let's hope he can do that.
Fair enough. Let's keep track on how the year progresses for all the young American players. But this Greek sensation, Stefanos Tsitsipas, I interviewed him 2 years ago when this podcast started. Mm. And now he's the talk of the town, the fastest rising stock in the men's tour. And today he delivered a performance for the ages as he defeated two-time defending champion Roger Federer. So what impresses you about his game? People say he has a very complete package. Are you buying all the hype that you're seeing, and what is his ceiling?
It's impossible to, that's obviously ridiculously obvious statement. I don't think there's overhype because he seems to have a very complete game and he seems to thrive in the big moments. So the question is, he had a great win against a great player. he's had a nice consistent record, but I don't think we're in the territory, rarefied territory, we're starting to say, well, this kid's, you know, on track to be one of the next great players. It's, but I didn't see the whole match, but I watched a lot of the highlights, and he certainly was able to, you know, move efficiently enough to be able to stay in these long exchanges with Federer. And like I said, he showed great prowess in the big moments. He didn't seem at all nervous to me. Now, that seems to be the case. And I think one thing folks at home have to realize is that when you start to get deep into Grand Slams for the first couple times in your career, the pressure just builds dramatically. I remember the first time I made the semis at Wimbledon, and I went into where before I had two or three people in the interview room, I went into the interview room, it was packed. Then I had to do TV for NBC, and I clearly remember Arthur Ashe saying, "Are you going to win this tournament?" And it kind of felt like I got hit over the head with a sledgehammer. All of a sudden, you're in a spotlight, and the question is, can you manage that in a way that excites you as opposed to overwhelms you? And that's going to be so interesting to see with any of these guys now who are stepping into this hole that's been left by Federer. So it's, people need to realize that all of a sudden now sponsors are calling. There's tons of requests for media. People are all over you on, I didn't have to deal with this, but with social media. And you wake up into a different world when you have a win like that. And so it's exciting to watch how a player manages that. And this is going to be the, and beating Federer certainly was going to draw the most attention. Like TFO's had some good wins. I mean, beating Kevin Anderson and then Dimitrov, I mean, those are big. But to beat Federer is as big as it gets. And so it's going to be really fun to watch who responds to that.
And Stefanos did beat Novak Djokovic in Toronto last year, but that was a best of three event. But you're right, beating Federer and Djokovic, that's as high an accolade you can get in the game. So let me ask you this, what he just said. You think this generation and this this young crew of players, because of social media, you think, are they better prepared for the exposure? Or is it an overkill? I know you're not close to the tour these days, but all these guys, they live on social media, and you think the increasing demands, will this be a gradual transition for them, or this can still be overwhelming?
It's different for everybody, and whether they're social media or not, it takes a certain confidence to be able just to walk into that and focus on your tennis. I remember the first time I saw Boris Becker play, he was 15 years old. He got a wild card into a tournament in Frankfurt, and he walked on the court and was playing against the number 10 player in the world at that point, Sandy Mayer. And he ended up losing three sets, but he was not fazed one bit. He just seemed like, oh, I'm home and I'm comfortable. And then certainly he proved that when he was 17 and 18 and won Wimbledon. It just takes a special kind of person to step into that place, you know, whether it's Twitter or whether it's, you know, the Daily Mail in London, you know, and that's the X factor. And it's going to be fun to watch this kid deal with it, as it will, as the big three start to be pared away over the next whatever, however long. Tell me how long it's going to go on. We don't know, because certainly Djokovic and Nadal are still the favorites. Yep. But it's going to be fun to try to see somebody emerge, and nobody's even come close.
Absolutely. So not to deviate the conversation, but it's an opportunity I don't want to miss. So talking about Becker and your match in the 85 Wimbledon, when he, I guess, sprained his ankle and then was going to almost, you know, throw his hands up. But I guess his coach said, take a timeout. What is your recollection of that match and how good the draw was looking? Do you ever look back at that match? Had things gone the different way? Because Mac and Connors were playing, I think Kevin Curran took them out, so this could have been, I know it was three matches removed, but has the thought ever crossed your mind?
Oh yeah, definitely. But you know, I had a lot of chances at Wimbledon I never capitalized on. So that was just one of many. But yeah, I was playing really well that year. So, you know, who knows? I could have gone through. But you know, Boris did what he did. So it's funny. I just watched it on Amazon. They had a German biography of Becker. You know, where was he?
Yeah, it's on Netflix too.
Number of years. And I had never seen the film. And so I didn't even realize that Boris had actually, I was looking away towards the back of the court, and Boris had his hand stuck out.
Yeah.
So I didn't even realize it was that close. I guess other people knew that. So to me, it was. But now, I mean, it's all at this point, you know, I don't really think about it much. Sure, I would have loved to Wimbledon, but that it wouldn't have changed my life at this point. I mean, it would have been nice. It would have made some more money and had the memory of that. But I don't really think about it anymore. I mean, it was a great moment for tennis that. You know, that again, Boris was able to step up to the plate, and just at 17, it's just astonishing to be able to focus through that whole craziness. And then to be able to play great, not only in winning, but how big the guy was. I mean, he was such a superstar in Germany. We used to play a lot of tournaments there, and he was beyond Michael Jordan. I think he was more popular than, better known than, Prime Minister. And so who can do that? I mean, who can do that? That's one of the big questions with this group. It remains to be seen. I don't see anybody from a full player perspective, anybody on that level. I mean, I hope fans at home realize this is the most astonishing time in men's tennis, to have three of the greatest champions of all time close to the peaks of their career competing each other with a couple other guys thrown in. There's just nothing like it. I mean, I know Sampras and Agassi, but that was really a one-sided ordeal. And then there was McEnroe, Connors, and Borg, but that didn't last very long. And certainly Lendl and Becker didn't have the staying power. It's mind-blowing. I watch these guys play. It's just so beautiful.
So let's go back to Tsitsipas for one more question here. You think a win like this after this is such a high? You know, you think he'll have not like trouble focusing, but you know, could he come down to earth like when he plays Roberto Bautista Agut? You think that's probably a bigger challenge after you have such a win like Federer, because that's going to be a test for this young lad to keep the focus.
It's going to be a huge test for both of them. The biggest time. The time you're most vulnerable for a letdown is after a huge win. And now I'm sure both of these guys have their eye on the prize. They think, well, who knows? Maybe I could get this done. So it's going to be fun to watch how they manage those emotions. And yes, this is when he's going to be most vulnerable. Because the adrenaline release that happens after you finish that win is extraordinary. Then you go into the press, then you're surrounded by your whole team who's very excited about what's going on. Then you've got fans going crazy when you're getting in and out of the cars to your hotel. And that drains you. So how is he going to deal with that? It's what a great story to follow.
Yeah, definitely. He's putting his country on the tennis map.
That's the other thing too. I'm really glad you brought that up. Because individual players have completely changed the direction of a whole nation. We saw that with Becker, and then obviously Steffi in Germany. Borg, obviously, in Sweden.
Nishikori. So,
Djokovic, you know, these guys and gals, really, Lina in China. I mean, come on, these you have huge impacts on your own country. And you become giant superstars for a country that has never had a great player. It's really, really exciting.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the legend himself, Roger Federer. Again, his tennis obituary, you know, has been written for the last decade or so, and he keeps extending time, and he's still a contender. I mean, that's the biggest accolade. My colleague Max Zemek said earlier, you know, at 37, he loses a match and his fans are upset and people are criticizing him, and that's the biggest accolade the man can get. How ridiculous
is
that?
Why did he criticize? To clear up, I read a tweet that said people were criticizing him. Who was criticizing him?
I mean, criticizing out of love, because a lot of time fans become hard. He didn't convert like any break point, and had he converted few, it could have been a different scoreline. There's always a narrative, not to take anything away from the young Greek from his performance. But, you know, Federer and Murta Tunga, who also contributes on our site, said that Federer, again, not to take anything away from Tsitsipas, seemed a step slower, but that could be the scoreboard pressure, that could be the length of the match.
I clearly remember having wonderful discussions, arguments with friends back in 2008, 2009. He's done, he's toast, he's finished, lost a step. And I just kept telling these guys that they're wrong. I didn't see it then, and I still don't see it now, frankly. How many matches has he won like that in majors where it's 7-6, but he converts the breaker, or he hits one good shot that turns things around? But at some point, you have to wonder, can he maintain it? And I didn't see from that performance anything close to questioning it. So I don't think he's there yet.
But he did announce that he'll play a clay schedule this year.
I know. Isn't that exciting? That's just going to be fantastic. I just think it's, you could read that a million different ways. You could say he's winding down, so he wants one more shot. He just doesn't seem like he gets down from losses. He seems like he's moving beautifully. And I think if he's allowed to take these long breaks, he comes back strong.
Our take is, as a group, we were discussing what to write for the website. So a bunch of us shared some notes, and one of the logic that prevailed was like he needs to have a top 8 ranking for Wimbledon, where is his best chance besides Australia. So he would definitely play clay, and he can still beat a lot of players in clay. So that could keep
his
ranking.
That's an interesting point. But I thought he had decided on the clay before.
No, he made the call today. He said he was leaning towards it, but nothing was official.
Okay, because I had sort of inferred he had before. So yeah, that's an interesting understanding too of the ranking situation too. You know, so you'd only have to play two or three of the best guys on the way to Wimbledon final.
Yeah, he wouldn't want to play Djokovic.
But,
in the
I'm sure
round.
He's excited to get back on the clay.
Yeah,
and I would say that in relation to American tennis, I do hope that, and this is something I didn't do. I never would have been a good clay court player, but I do hope the Americans go over and play on the red clay, because I do think it's critical to developing the kind of balance and efficiency of movement that the best players have to have. And I, you know, it's telling to me that all the best players are coming out of clay court situations. I just don't think that Roger's done yet. I really don't.
Yeah, and I think to your point about Americans embracing clay, I think TFO and Donaldson, I think kudos to both these guys, because they were there playing the 250s leading up to the 1000s and then the major last year, so they did play a full cycle. And that's what I think, if you want to succeed at this level, what you're saying, you should embrace all surfaces equally.
Yeah, and clay makes you do a lot of things that are different, and particularly the efficient movement of shot to shot to shot to shot in long sequences. And that's when you play in hard court with American balls, you don't have to deal with that. When you go to Europe or play in the really slow hard courts, you've got to do that. And so I think there's nothing like clay. And the other thing, and I've gotten a few discussions with friends about this too, the balls are much heavier in Europe. So it's on the clay, it's much more difficult to penetrate through the court if you're off balance or if your technique's not perfect. So with the combination of slower courts, heavier balls, it exacts a price and demands efficiency, so that all the players, Americans, and playing green clay is just not the same. Hard shoe is a very different surface than red clay.
Mm. And just a quick question on the world number one, Novak Djokovic. He's turned his year around. Last time we spoke, he was, you know, having his elbow injury, and now he's clearly the best player on the planet. What does his level look to you? I know, again, the conversation among fans is he close to 2015? And I ask this question to everyone. Even if he's a note or two below, he's still good enough to, I think, win two majors a year.
He looks as good to me as 2015. In fact, most of my book is written around his technique. So, and he is, like you said, he seems best on the planet. And that's just the balance and the movement. But most of all, it's really the desire is back. And why he lost that and why he got it back, who knows? I really don't know. But for him, it was not the loss of anything with his game. It just had to do with his resolve to want to get in there and play like he can. So he certainly seems like the man to beat, but you know, we all, it's so funny how if Federer loses, you sort of think, oh my God, the world's changing. So, you know, Djokovic could lose. He plays Medvedev now, I think. So, you know, he could, it could be interesting, But yeah, Djokovic has been astonishing since he had this revival.
Sure. So, Tim, as promised, we covered a lot of top male players here in the draw. Let's talk about some of the issues. You know, on-court scheduling is one of the issues that tennis tournaments have to deal with, at least from the fan accounts, and they let the Twitter handles know that some of these scheduling practices are not transparent enough or consistent enough. And let's talk about the Konta Muguruza match that started way past midnight. If you are a player, you've lived through that. I'm sure US Open had night matches even in your time. So, I mean, do you understand where the tournament director is going? But at the same time, what kind of conversations need to be had when these kind of scenarios are avoided, when players are taking court at 12:30 a.m., which is not good for anyone?
As with everything, it's a balance between the needs and finances of the tournament and the benefits or drawbacks of the players. And that's, you know, I would have thought that a lot of this had been taken care of with the roofs, because it seemed that a lot of the, by having the roofs there, then you're not going to run into as many rain delays. And certainly with the stadium matches, you're going to have that fixed. So that you would hope the situation got better, but in fact, it's gotten worse. Now that they've obviously dealt with it by cutting down the extent of the final set with the three sets or the five sets. That to finish at 3 a.m, that's insane. They have to find a way to not put that match on. I just think it's crazy. I think the latest I finished the match was maybe 1:45 a.m. at the Open, which was just extremely draining because for the obvious reasons, you start so late. But the other thing to remember is that you're now spending the whole day before that awake. So let's say you get up at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, that's your normal schedule. Then all of a sudden you have to stay awake for the 12 hours that you would normally be either practicing, eating and resting, or playing your match. So 3 a.m, it's just an unfair advantage. And I think a player would rather go back to back days than have to deal with starting at, what do they start at? I don't know, 12:30, what was it, 12:30 or something like that. So I think that's absolutely crazy. And I would side with the players on that. They shouldn't have put them out that late.
And scheduling also runs beyond, you know, like the issues at Wimbledon, again, and Australian Open, Federer and Murray, these names are tossed around that they don't leave the center court, or Federer gets a lot of night matches. And this conversation has gained some serious momentum, and fans complain of, you know, this preferential treatment, conflict of interest, so many things that, you know, are spoken about. Do you think a players' union could be a one conclusive answer where all interests are represented equally, and these kind of conversations can take a back seat, or maybe there's more transparency needed before we arrive to a union?
Well, the union's a whole nother issue, because I'm not sure if folks realize it, but as it stands now, the tournament directors in the ATP Tour have a share. They actually own the franchise of that particular week. So how you're going to disband that system and disconnect those from the players is a is an absolute financial legal quagmire that I don't know if it's ever going to, you know, we're going to come out of that. There's no simple answer to any of this. It's every year when I was president of Player Council and on the board of directors for 6 years, and the same issues just keep circling back. First, the balancing the top players versus the lower level players. So that's one problem that you have. The tournament directors are looking out for the top players because those are the folks that sell the tickets in their mind. So you've got that quotient. Then you've got the scheduling year round. So players keep saying they want fewer tournaments and a bigger off season. And yet when they do that, then they say that, then all of a sudden they're off to Southeast Asia for the international team championship for $1 million a match, or they're voting in all these new team championships. So no, there's no simple answer. And a player commissioner or a player union is not going to fix the problems. They're going to be able to address certain problems better than others. But and the players, I think, at least in my time, were very unaware of the actual business dealings and the balancing that the tournaments have to do, because you've got to make sure that you've got the right matches to fill in the right time. And they're looking at ratings, and they're looking at ticket sales, and they're looking at sponsors. And so the players think, well, we're just going to be fair about everything, but this is business as well as sport. And tennis, there's nothing like tennis that has to deal with it, because in every other sport, you know when the event's going to start and you know when it's going to finish. And you don't have all these moving pieces, and you're never going to fix that. So, you know, Federer gets the best court, then who's upset? Djokovic. So then he becomes one in the world. And then, you know, so it's just, there's no simple answer to it.
And tennis, like you said, is very unique compared to other sports where the venue and time is fixed, and one venue is not allotted to other competitors on the same day. That's how it goes. So yeah, so that was a tennis union perspective. But then let's talk about another issue in tennis with Justin Gimelstab. There's a hearing, the legal hearing, that's still pending, but there has been a lot of commotion regarding his participation in a vote. He's still eligible on the committee to go and vote for a removal of a member, or there's some sort of power struggle, and a lot of people believe that he should not be actively participating. I know you and a few others have spoken about this. If you understand, you know, what's going on, what's your take on it? Because you once served in the ATP Tour Players Council. How you view that situation with all the conflicts and all the dilemmas surrounding it?
There's two separate issues. One is to have a person, and tennis has many, that are wearing so many hats that the conflicts are just wrong. So Patrick McEnroe, for instance, was in the booth for ESPN and the Tennis Channel while he was the player director of USTA tennis. So first of all, he should have been able to, you know, he'd be more focused on his job if he wasn't doing both. Second of all, there's just an inherent conflict of interest in that. Gimelstab's in a situation, and I actually was in a similar situation, but on a much smaller scale. There was not the climate that we're in now, but I did some broadcasting and I was on the tour board, and that's just wrong. You shouldn't do that. Now, so the idea that you're a coach for Isner, a broadcaster for the Tennis Channel, and on the Player Council and the tour board is just, that's shouldn't be allowed. I don't understand why anybody would allow that. You know, he's a coach not only of a player but of a top player.
So you think, let me ask this, hold the train of thought, but what you said about yourself and even Patrick, you think this not only impacts, you know, the level of job you're doing, but at the same time, you think that also makes you a partial voice when you have to commentate on certain issues? Because
Absolutely. No, I mean, come on. It's, you know, Patrick certainly was talking up U.S. tennis when he was in the booth. That's I'm sure that's part of the reason USTA put him there. But that's not appropriate, and it's not his job should have been running U.S. tennis. You know, and how do you improve that? And my job should have just been being a tour, you know, on the tour board. Now you can do other things. You could coach on a, you know, at a club or be a touring pro, but nothing with the conflicts that that's. And to have Gimbelstob doing player interviews, being on the board, and and coaching, it's crazy. But tennis is rife with it. He's not the only one that's doing this. This is all over the place. And it just is bad for the sport. It's just it just looks and is ugly for the sport.
And that just there's another instance where Tennis Channel is going to be on the campus of the USTA, and that's kind of another conflict of interest, that reporting can't be done from one of the major houses of tennis. And I know you even spoke about that on Twitter.
Yeah, it's crazy. Why would they have their studios at the place that they're covering? You know, we live in a crazy world in which the press, so to speak, has been swallowed up into the business of news in general. And I think tennis can only benefit by having those things separate. And I love the USTA. They do a lot of great things, but they're not afraid to spin things in their favor. And there's a lot of things they don't do well, and they should be called out for it. Now, folks might remember there was a great magazine that was edited by Gene Scott back in the day. And it, you know, provided a source where there was real significant criticism, appropriate criticism of the game. And that's what we need. And I just don't understand why. No, I understand why it's happening, because I'm sure the USTA offered a really great studio, and they want to bring attention to the tennis center in Orlando. But to me, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this is like
go ahead.
No, I was just citing an example I read a long time ago. This is like a group of journalists, you know, covering war, but traveling with the troops. So I guess the objectivity somehow gets impaired.
Well, it's not so much traveling with the troops, because the press does have to travel with the players. There's no question. But if it's as if the big organization that's running everything is hosting the site of it would be like the New York Times moved into the Democratic National Committee. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, how can you cover something when your headquarters is at the place where you're supposed to cover them? Now, most people just say, well, tennis is just all about entertainment, and we don't need this kind of separation. But, you know, at times, even in tennis, you need that, whether it's, you know, questions of difficulty in the sport. I know a lot of other sports have had trouble with various issues, both to do with money and to with protecting the athletes, the younger athletes, and tennis needs a voice that can keep that separate. Now, you know, the other tough question with Justin is, you know, is he guilty or not? And I personally wouldn't want somebody who is I just don't think it's appropriate that a person with so much power could, if he's convicted of a felony, just shouldn't be in that spot. That just doesn't make any sense to me. Nothing against Justin. I just think it sets a really bad example that one of the top power brokers in the sport is guilty of a felony.
Yeah, I think let's keep following this case, how it unfolds, and what will come out of it as far as tennis goes, and
and it's just sad. I mean, it's sad to have these families involved, and you know, it's just a lot of sadness in the whole situation. But I think what's good for tennis is to have people who you feel represent the values of the sport. And certainly in this day and age, we need that. But you know, maybe Justin's innocent or not guilty or whatever. And you know, then they can, with comfort, have him in that position. But regardless, I don't think he should be at the Tennis Channel coaching and being on the board of directors.
Mm. All right, Tim.
And so, nobody should be in that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I think once again, you're very generous with your time. I think we covered quite a few topics. This should hopefully be a good listen for the audiences. Once again, I want to thank you, Tim Mayotte, taking your time out on a Sunday and talking to us. I'm sure you will be watching more tennis, and we'll follow your Twitter account, and we can have you back once your book is released on the show.
It's been an honor, and we're very lucky to be involved in this great sport.
Thank you very much.
This is a Crush Performance Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Everywhere we look, there are these storied franchises and organizations that just seem to have it together. Well, what goes on inside of those organizations? Where did they come from? How did they get there? That's going to be the conversation today as we talk with high performance strategist Brandon Marcello. You can check his information out at BrandonMarcelloPhD.com. I wanted to get Brandon on to address this early in the season as it's one of our overlying themes. We're also going to spend a lot of time this year talking about recovery and sleep. It's our number one priority for human performance. So inside of those cultures, we have to make sure that we're taking care of the individuals that make these things tick. And if we're not doing a good job there, well, flat out bottom line is your organization can't be successful.
Crush Performance with Jeff Crushell can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.